Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent investment performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. A word on our other sponsor, Bremont, an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers, designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch, brought to you by our title partner, the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont. The FT has described my guest today as one of the 30 most influential people in the City of London. And in the world of public and private investing, there is repeated acknowledgement of him being one of today's great investment thinkers. The firm he joined back in 2001, Lansdowne Partners, is widely admired amongst the global institutional investment community. And its beating heart, Peter Davis, has helped them earn this reputation. So, Pete, it's terrific to have you on the Money Maze podcast. I've known you for many years, so thank you, first of all. And second, it's great to be doing this interview in person. Welcome to the new world.
Thank you very much. No, I agree. One's missed that.
I spoke to two people who originally hired you into Mercury Asset Management, Stephen Zimmerman and Carol Galley. Don't wince. The investment icons of that organization and generation. Would you like to know what they had to say?
Turning into This Is Your Life, isn't it? No, I'm not sure.
So Stephen Zimmerman said, when we hired him, we took him into our high performance unit. We saw he was exceptional. We never had any doubt Pete would be successful. And Carol Galley added, he was also so much admired by everyone for being so straightforward and modest and kind. Now, modest and kind, which most of us agree are not overused terms in the world of finance. But I heard that modesty in action when you told Ulick Burke from Numis that you had the perfect face for radio. So, Pete, welcome. It's great to have you here.
No, it's lovely to be on. I love listening to them, and it's lovely to have a sort of opportunity to chat. Looking forward to it.
So I hope today we're going to discuss a number of things, starting with your investing career to date, your approach to evaluating companies, public and private, the exciting IP being developed around Oxford University, and why you think the business landscape today has parallels with the UK after World War II, and other important perspectives, geopolitical and investment. But just going back a little bit, growing up, you were intrigued with cricket scores and weather reports. Why?
I think we were talking earlier about whether there was anything in my childhood that made me think I might enjoy investing. And I think the common feature of a few of my hobbies was a combination of sort of solving puzzles and trying to understand things which are uncertain, which definitely, when we come on to talk about what we do now, is a really important part of understanding markets properly. So I love detective stories, things like cricket and stuff. I played endless dice games, endless batting averages, and as you say, weather forecasting, horse racing. A lot of the things I enjoyed doing were about uncertainty and trying to sort of get a handicap on uncertainty. And I think the fascinating thing about, especially stock market investing, is that you've got this tension whereby you're always working off imperfect information. And at some level, the stock price represents other people's views of that imperfect information at a point in time. And so the skill set of doing better than other people or trying to identify good investments is, can you, from the same piece of information, get more original and more accurate thoughts than other people? I mean, it's that lovely thing of having to be both original and accurate is, I think, what makes, in particular, stock market investing so fascinating and actually quite similar to some of those things I used to do when I was younger.
So cast your mind back to Oxford University. What do you recall as the favourite moments?
I don't think I want to recall. I think the whole point about one's favourite moments about university is you shouldn't recall them age 49. I think maybe I was very, very lucky at Oxford that I had the most wonderful tutor, a guy called Ralph Walker, who really taught me to think and sort of be precise in my thinking. I studied PPE, mainly did philosophy, and actually did very little economics, found it actually quite dull at university. And it's strange, actually, now when I think about what I do day in, day out, and trying to really distill down the essence of whether it's a company pitch, whether it's an investment proposition, actually the way he taught me, which was for me to read something out, him to be incredibly precise about whether there was a sort of ambiguity in what I was saying or a potential error for it. You know, it didn't matter what I'd written, he would find the killer argument the other way around. And that precision, I think, is tremendously important. There's a lot of stories you hear when you're listening to potential investments. And, you know, that skill of saying, well, actually, what is it this relies on to be true, was something that he taught me wonderfully. I mean, I remember writing an essay for him, which was effectively paraphrasing his book. And, you know, he just tore me to shreds. And I was sitting there going, you know, this is your view. I know this is your view. And yet he had the flexibility of mindset to do that. And I think if I ever live up to that in investing, then that mode of thinking has taught me incredibly well. And actually, oddly enough, the problems that you deal with, or that I was dealing with then, so I did a lot of stuff on philosophy of language, which either is a word means something because it refers to something objective in the real world, or a word means something because people use the word in a particular way. And most of what I was trying to do was say, look, there's some obvious elements of truth in both of those, but yet they seem opposed to one another. How does one synthesize those two? And actually, it's not a million miles away from stock markets. You know, stock markets at one level operate with people's emotions and views, and the share price is whatever a share price. One thing Stephen Zimmerman taught me is, in my interview, is he asked me the question of what makes the share price go up, and I was belaboring all this reading I'd done about, you know, PE multiples, et cetera, all these valuation multiples. And I made a mess of it for 10 minutes, and he said, more buyers than sellers. And I said that, and he was obviously right. At one level, stock markets are this simplification of a share price represents what people think of a company at a point in time. At another level, share price is how does a company develop objectively? Does it make more profits and so forth? And trying to reconcile those two is often very hard. You meet a lot of investors who are really good at one of them and not particularly good at the other one, or worry about the other one, or don't think it's important. And actually, oddly enough, the problem I was facing a lot academically at Oxford was exactly that same problem of how do you reconcile meaning to be both objective and conventional, as it were. So I think it helped in any number of ways, but mainly because I was very lucky to have an amazing tutor, but also make an amazing bunch of friends, which many of my best friends today are people I met then. And the human aspect of life is more important than, you know, the professional one at some level to me.
So you arrive at Mercury, which, as we discussed, had this, you know, formidable reputation. And how did you start to develop your investment approach?
So Mercury was an incredible place. At one level, it had this tension between, it had a huge, huge market share. I don't know the exact numbers, but I would guess that it probably invested over 5% of all the assets in the UK stock market, which is way higher than any other active manager I think has ever done, and almost meant that they were the market. And yet it had also got that success while still being, and partly because of still being the sort of maverick, it wasn't a popular thing to do to go into fund management. And that meant that it had this lovely, lovely heritage of having, including me, it was never the first place that people wanted to go to in the milk ground. And they deliberately played on that by hiring an incredible range of characters whose main skill, I think, was being differentiated. And then once they got there, each of those people was basically left alone to solve the same problem. So you probably had 40 fund managers, all very talented and idiosyncratic, all effectively trying to deal with the same problem, namely which are the best shares to invest. And so for me, what was lovely was I got there and saw 40 different approaches to the same problem, some of which intuitively identified with because enjoyed analysis or could do the analysis pretty well numerically. and others of which more emotionally driven, more sentiment driven, and I had no idea about. And so I had this lovely period where you were just seeing different people succeed at different times, different views expressed. And effectively, it was an internal market. You know, what was so weird about Mercury then is it almost was the market. If you were the best fund manager in Mercury, that was kind of deemed to be synonymous with being as talented as, I mean, it seems very parochial now, but was synonymous with being as good a fund manager as there probably was in the UK. It was quite competitive internally, which is good. I enjoyed. And also by having these idiosyncratic characters, it was just fun. The nice thing was each day was really, really enjoyable. And you heard people express views. And for me, I always learn. I'd love to say I learned from my mistakes, which have been a huge number of, but actually I've always found it easier to learn from other people's mistakes. And seeing different things tried, different things work, a sort of sequence was just the best apprenticeship I could have imagined at the time.
And why is it that so many firms in the active management space struggle with this idea of combining intellectual freedom and inquisitiveness?
I think they struggle with combining intellectual freedom with a consistent brand message externally. The problem you've got is that if you've got an aggregated fund management firm, people understandably assume that that should provide the same product for all their customers. And yet almost by definition, if you're going to provide the same product at scale, you're going to end up with averaging out people's views rather than emphasizing the idiosyncratic things. So certainly one of the things that I love about Lansdowne and think is exactly how I would like to work as a fund manager is that we focus on a very strong central infrastructure and central ethos, as it were, in terms of good people, but we don't try and mandate how every fund should operate and have different clients for each fund. Very clear notion that a fund manager should be free to decide how they want to add value, but they should be able to rely on the beauty of the central infrastructure that we have being so strong, is that I, as a fund manager, don't have to waste my time doing stuff I'm probably not very good at. It's very hard to present a consistent brand to the outside world, and yet the branding of fund management demands that.
So before, we are going to talk about Lansdowne in a minute, but before we leave Mercury, after you'd been there a little while, you had some early successes, investment successes. Maybe just reflect on how those came about.
One of the things that Mercury did very well was allow people to try under supervision their hand at fund management much earlier than would now be possible. I mean, I remember my first failures much more than my first successes. I mean, actually, oddly enough, I kind of did okay to start with. You're not wedded to anything and, you know, faced with it. So I think I benefited from that for a couple of years. I also was lucky in that the market I started off in was not particularly macro influenced. I started after the ERM stuff, which I'm sure would have thoroughly confused me. It was a long time before the next major macro influence emerged on markets, and by which time I was able to understand it a bit better. I was lucky then. I did okay to start with, and then remember had an incredibly tough time. Then about 3 years into my career, it was interesting, actually, a broader point that we should make is I then had a bit of bad luck, but actually bad luck that kind of revealed an underlying weakness in that I had two companies turn out to be absolute frauds. And you'd think for someone being analytic, that should be the main thing one's able to avoid. But actually, one lesson I've learned is that genuine fraud is almost the hardest thing for an analyst to spot, because if one relies on an attempt at accuracy from data, and if the data is inaccurate, you're working off. For me, it was particularly difficult because what would end up happening would be that the market would be sort of alert to the idea that these were frauds, you know, smarter people than me who did it emotionally. And so put them on very low valuations, which of course to someone like me who is at the time probably, well, as I realized retrospectively, overly confident in my analysis, only attracted me more. You know, I'd sit there saying the market's made a terrible mistake here. It's pricing them at half the value of a comparative company. The numbers all make sense. And both of them turned out to be worth less than zero. So that was my first big challenge, which was hard. But I was very lucky. I'm Stephen and Carol and other colleagues I had then, they were fantastic to me. I don't know exactly how they did it, but find the way to help one learn from it, which has been very lucky.
Then in 1998, Steve Hines and Sir Paul Ruddock had founded Lansdowne, which today I know has 10 billion of assets, 84 people, 29 investment professionals. And you arrive in 01. And what were the inputs that persuaded you to join?
I'd kind of decided it would be a recurring theme that both for personal reasons and because of the market I thought one was in, that we'd just gone through the tech bubble and I decided I'd like to run a hedge fund. I do shorting as well as long opportunities, partly because I felt I wanted to progress and sort of I'd just done long only investing. To the point we made earlier about finding what's good and bad in people's analysis, I quite like the shorting profile of saying everyone loves this thing, but actually there's a fundamental flaw to it. And I wanted to see whether I could do it or not. And so I was very keen to run a hedge fund, and Lansdowne at the time, as it is hopefully now, was well known for that and had the infrastructure for that. And I was lucky that I was moving with a colleague of mine, Stuart, who will recur many, many times in this. And so, you know, we had discussion around it about what the right thing. And I think both of us realized that A, we didn't want, and B, we wouldn't be very good at the sort of foundation of, I mean, one of the weird things about the hedge fund world is that people, they want you to be a super entrepreneur who's going to set up their own company at the same time as setting up a fund that manages risk very well. And yet, for both Stuart and me, you know, the idea that we'd take on all the risk associated with running a business at the same time we were doing this, I mean, it's kind of the weird thing that people want you to take an idiotic amount of risk. Anyway, and so for both Stuart and I think A, we recognize that we wouldn't be very good at it, and B, that wasn't what we wanted to do. And then I think the other thing that appealed was obviously Paul and Steve had created a perfect platform for us at two levels. One, I think the idea that the infrastructure and the quality of all the stuff that we would be using to do our fund management was without equal, as hopefully it is still, and incredibly high quality. And two, I think the brand of it, I mean, I think the very fact it wasn't named after a person was quite appealing and still is. I mean, you kindly described me as, I would rather not be viewed as the beating heart of a company, because I think the whole beauty of a good fund management company is personalizing it, exposes it to A, risk, which is probably manageable, but B, certainly for me in joining somewhere, the idea I could make a big difference to it. If you'd had a big name on the door, you're kind of inherently limiting that. So I think everyone would feel in retrospect it was the right call. But I remember a lot of people saying to us, or saying to me as well, why didn't you go and set up a company all from scratch? One of the things fund managers often underestimate is the infrastructure that they build their businesses on is not a trivial thing. And we were very lucky to have the heritage that Steve and Paul had created, but also the business that they'd created was ready-made for us to go. And probably the most telling insight from that is the time I spent between Mercury and here was spent researching companies rather than most of my friends who've gone off and set up their own businesses. A, it's a lot much longer time frame, and B, all their time is spent doing stuff they're not very good at, which is not great.
And the barriers have become inexorably higher and tougher for people thinking about, you know, leaving large firms.
Yeah, I mean, the regulatory costs is higher now, which is a shame.
So you go from an investment that focus that is predominantly UK to changing the mandate to being global, and you were very early with the big tech platform companies.
The way I would put it was we were a UK investor through the 2000s. Through the global financial crisis, we did a reasonably good job of understanding that. And actually it was in a area that, because it was a banking crisis, it was quite easy for us to analyze. And as a hedge fund, obviously, we had the opportunity to protect some of our long positions through some of our short positions and do okay in the downdraft, and managed to sort of capture the early returns through just simple cyclical recovery in 2009. Through that process, we had been moving. You know, obviously, the epicenter of that was not just in the UK, the global financial, as the name conveys. So we'd been doing a lot of analysis and finding a lot of opportunities outside the UK on the short side during that period. But then we went through a really interesting, after the initial recovery, we spent a lot of time looking for where the best opportunities globally were with a fairly open mind. Yeah, ended up, from a bottom-up perspective actually first, it was actually originally premised off emerging market demand rather than technology. So we ended lots and lots of Coca-Cola, Colgate, but just saying, look, to this theme, the best way to express it after a financial crisis was actually in big, big global equities, a lot of whom were in the US. And through that sequencing probably was, that was where we found the best opportunities in 2009-10. Because of that, we were spending, talking to our clients saying, look, we're just finding more stuff in the US than we used to. And through that, actually, almost time in the US, gradually spent more time on tech. And as you say, ended up investing in some of the tech monoliths reasonably early, and as well as some tech companies that didn't do so well. So it was 2011-12. And you know, the nice thing was it was driven, I hope most of the decisions we've taken about which products to run have been started from the premise of what companies do we want to invest in. And then how do we articulate that investment best? And certainly, both in launching a long-only product then and being more global then, it was just because these companies were just too cheap relative to, and they were the best exposure one could get to global economic growth, which is effectively what one's trying to do.
It is obvious for anybody now, but it wasn't as obvious. And you espoused other names like Nvidia, etc. So what was it that was happening that you were seeing that was available to everybody else investing?
Again, it's that point 2 or 3 years after the macro crisis where you can kind of see these trends. And interestingly, I think possibly today, one can perhaps see it a tiny bit earlier, some of the new trends emerging, is that you kind of get to the point where the trends are, I don't know, 20%. They're 20% of the way through. And actually, at that point, as an investor, you can be pretty confident they're going to go to 100% over a period of time. When we talk about today, those trends which are, to give you an example, I would say that the replacement of plastics with paper packaging is kind of a classic thing, which is so obviously going to happen over 10 years, given ESG concerns. And it's already at the point where you can kind of tell who's going to benefit and who's not going to benefit. But the proportion of packaging that has been replaced by that plastics replacement is at a very early stage. And while sometimes that will be over discounted in shares, at the very least, that's normally an interesting place to start.
I want to go back to 06, 07 and shorting. Northern Rock became, I think you were short, close to 10% of the company. It was one of the largest shorts on record. And I think I'm right in saying that the fund generated almost $500 million of profit through being short through stock and options. And our mutual friend Rick Saunders said it was one of the most profitable shorts ever made by a fund in the history of the world. So what was it that you were seeing as this was embryonic in the great financial crisis? What was it that you were seeing specifically that got your focus?
Well, what was interesting, and Rick's a good example of this, that actually the first thing I should say is that for 2 years before 2006, what we saw was in 2004-05. So this was a rare example where for 2 years we were 100% wrong about the share price action, but it turned out okay in the end. So I think what we saw, there were two layers to this. The first layer was something that we'd always seen from 2004-05, which was that the funding model was such that if anything went a bit wrong, it would go very wrong very quickly. And again, I think to this question of what do you need to know and not need to know, to me, that what was fascinating to me and what made it such an appealing investment as a short was basically the way I thought about it was something's bound to go wrong over the next 5 years. And it's such a flawed model that I'm not going to spend very much time working out what is the thing that's going to go wrong, because you just can't, the chance that nothing goes wrong. So to me, the lack of knowledge was almost an advantage in the investment because I knew the underlying vulnerability, which is ultimately what happened. You know, the thing that eventually went wrong, I had a myriad of things that could go wrong, most of which were around credit risk. And actually, to be fair to Northern Rock, I don't think there's much evidence that they ever realized it, that many bad debts out of it. It was just they had a funding model that would eventually, because their funding model was reliant on investor perception of the company in the debt markets, if that investor perception ever got worse, then they would run out of funding very quickly. And when banks run out of funding, equity holders rarely end up with much capital. So the first thing was that we did that. And then the second, because of that, when we got to 2006-07, two things were the case that allowed us to make a lot more than we otherwise would have. So we were short probably, I don't know, a third of our terminal position for most of those 2 or 3 years. The first was that clearly the general risk around wholesale funding was much more obvious in 2006-07. Strangely, the market hadn't applied a huge discount to Northern Rock, even though it was the most reliant on wholesale funding. And so you could kind of begin to see how it would go wrong very quickly at that time. And then secondly, the way in which we structured it, weirdly, one thing that we did do, I think was intelligent, was that we bought lots of put options on it. And weirdly, the thing that Stuart and Jonathan and I noted at the time was that the way in which people priced up options for banks was exactly the same way they priced up options for other companies. And yet, normally when a share price goes down a long way, actually it turns out to be quite cheap in the end. When bank share prices go down 50%, they almost invariably go down 100%, which was doubly true of Northern Rock, because of the wholesale funding. So because of that, we were very fortunate that we were able to buy a lot of put options that amplified the position when it started going wrong. I mean, interestingly, to me, the biggest inconsistency about Northern Rock was, an analytic one that never really has been answered properly, which was that people remember they had a very big market share in mortgages, i.e. they were very competitive with other mortgage companies in what was a very competitive market. And yet when you analyzed it, they had much higher margins on their lending than anyone else. They had the highest asset margins, as we describe it, in the sector. So what was optically weird was they were coming across to the consumer as super price sensitive, but to the shareholder, they were coming across as making the highest spread of anyone else. I had my suspicions as to what was happening, but that fundamental tension of it can't simultaneously be the case you're the best value for the customer and the most profitable person for shareholders without an obvious advantage that wasn't obvious in this case, still to me was what ultimately should have gone wrong for them, even though actually, as it happens, I'm not sure it ever did. But that's a long story that probably isn't for now.
Right. But just staying with the shorting for a minute, you run a series of successful shorts for a long time. The fund grows a lot courtesy of its performance, and you no longer short. So the question I guess I have is, did size become the enemy or shorting, or why don't you think those opportunities are ones you want to pursue?
So to scroll forward, Northern Rock, etc. is 2007-08. I think we're fairly clear in 2009 that we weren't going to do much shorting in that period. But then from 2011 on, just because the market was so extreme that shorts were unlikely to work, and you know, we were launching a long-only product in the next couple of years, so logically the amount of shorts we would expect to find wasn't going to be so great. But for the next 7 or 8 years, with varying degrees of success, we kept shorting quite happily and were quite happy with the hedge fund structure. Post-COVID, or March, April last year, was basically when I decided that personally I didn't think that shorting was the best thing. I'd say I didn't think that shorting was the thing I really wanted to do for the next 5 or 10 years. And I think there were both personal and professional logic to that. And there is also really important, as we'll talk about in a sec, I really wanted to do some of the venture investing we're doing now more actively and professionally, as it were. And there is just a time constraint. I was very clear that if I was going to do that better, I had to not do something else. And so when I was thinking about what I could not do, shorting was the most time consumptive thing that I didn't feel was necessarily optimal for the next decade for me. As to why I thought that, I think there are probably three dynamics. One was that we did very well on some commodity shorts during the 2010s and stuff like that. Going back to why I joined Lansdowne, I didn't feel there was that much new I could do on shorting that would intellectually give me huge satisfaction. So I think I'm probably always trying to push myself a bit to do new stuff and see whether I can do it well or not. I think intellectually I didn't feel that there was that much personal upside from what I'm sure will be some very good shorts that people find in the next 5 or 6 years. Secondly, I think from a professional standpoint, it felt to me there were two aspects of shorting at the moment that were likely to be difficult for me personally. One was that, especially with zero rates, massive stimulus, etc., I think it's very hard to judge how much money you can lose holding a short before you're right. Prospectively, I think the combination of doing early stage venture with listed is a really nice one in terms of ensuring that one's spotting change and thinking about change. And actually the analysis is quite complementary. And conversely, you know, especially if you think where might the shorts be around today, it's going to be super high value tech or fraudulent companies. The reality, I suspect, is neither of those two is really going to help your analysis. And it's going to be really fun analysis to do. I've got an ex-colleague of mine who's gone off to do this, and amongst other things, and really talented analysts will do really good analytic work. But I couldn't see how that would particularly help me understand other stuff. You know, if you spot a Wirecard's a fraud or something, that's great and tremendously satisfying, but it doesn't really help you elsewhere in your investment case.
Doesn't have the payoffs. I get it. And two different things strike me looking through the Lansdowne materials. One is you talk about, as a firm, the willingness to engage with a wide range of outcomes, which is quite refreshing and quite difficult, because we have lots of people in this industry, and I might have been guilty of that as well, and you get quite convinced by your own reading rhetoric perspective. How do you encourage that as a culture?
What's so fascinating about growing up as a fund manager? We talked earlier about when you first started, you had no preconceptions or anything else, but you had no experience. Having been doing it now for 25 years, you've kind of got the benefits of having seen lots of different markets and seen different industries emerge in different ways. But equally, that strength can very readily become a weakness, both in terms of your position. And I think there's an element generally, actually, in fund management, which is whatever you're good at probably is also the thing that's going to cause you problems. And the way I sometimes describe it is, I know you're a golfer, but well, actually, no, are you a golfer?
Yeah, that, some might say that's a very debatable point, so we'll pass on.
Anyway, certainly for my golf, you kind of get to that question of, you know, you hit the ball in a particular way, and you've got this debate of, do you aim off a bit or do you try and restructure your swing? I think the reality is that a lot of our management is aiming off a bit for your natural biases and understanding oneself well enough to know that. My experience of generalized rules of fund management is that you only realize them when you should least realize them, i.e. when everyone is telling you the same thing, and actually you should do the opposite at that point in time. And B, they're very hard to implement, generalized rules of fund management, because actually where specific things are much better. You know, if you say, okay, look, so what I've tried to do more and more is say, I've got a difficult decision where something may be going wrong. What would be the threshold? One of the things Stuart taught me this when we worked together, and it's, especially when things were going wrong, you'd endlessly debate things and you can't help but there's a real danger that the person who's just been right is the person who is deemed to be likely to get it right next time. And I think where we got to with an equilibrium on that was what you can have a useful debate was trying to do something useful, which is say, okay, what evidence point am I looking for next in the future to just validate my thesis, validate it from a sort of long-term perspective. That's, I think, something I've tried to do more and more as my career has gone on, is say, okay, I'm probably not going to be in a good emotional state, let alone analytic state, and everything will be probably known about today. Let's make sure that we set the criteria of what happens next, because I found that easier to be disciplined about. You know, if I say, okay, the next numbers have got to be X rather than Y, and they turn out to be Y, it's so much easier to sell it in that thing. So that's the way I've tried to do it. But there is this basic point, which that basic point of how does one retain one's strengths while aiming off a bit for one's weaknesses, and reflects the fact that those strengths and weaknesses will change as you evolve as a fund manager, let alone the changes that go on in the real world. It's a wonderful job like that. You have to constantly adapt yourself. You're constantly adapting to yourself and to the markets. And some people ask me why I have done it now for such a long time, is that it's a different job today from 5 years ago, from 10 years ago. And the world is different, which is wonderful.
And in the next 5 to 10 years, what would give you the most satisfaction here at Lansdowne?
I think most of the time one gets, for me anyway, personally, most of my satisfaction is feeling that one's done as good a job as possible and being realistic about what that actually means. So there are times where it's almost impossible for someone with my approach to do it well. There's times where I hope I'm right to think as of now that the opportunity set is amazing for any number of reasons, and including being more domestically oriented again, rather than more global, and therefore something you would hope we should do quite well. I think the combination of doing things as well as I can do them with this time around, undoubtedly there'll be an element whereby I feel in advance pretty clear about how the world's likely to develop and where the opportunities are, and that's quite differentiated from other people. I hope that those things come through. I think the other aspect clearly is, both from Oxford and elsewhere, the link between investing wisely and creating real economic and social outcomes has always been there. I think with what we're doing at the moment and some of the projects we've got, our ability as a team to contribute to industries existing that don't currently exist will be hugely satisfying and rewarding if we do it. But I think having a real economic impact allied to just feeling like I've done something new really well is kind of those two motivations.
Yes. Now, for many years, you had Stuart Roden as your investing partner with whom you could sort of joust and debate, and to use a Latin term, quis custodiet ipsos custodes, who guards the guardians? Who asked you the difficult questions?
Well, Jonathan and Stuart and I worked very much to try and, I mean, Stuart is a wonderful person, and one of the good things I've had throughout my life, of which he's the best exemplar, is, you know, I talked about Ralph earlier as a tutor. You know, I've been incredibly lucky to have people help me develop with a kindness and wisdom that Stuart and others, but particularly Stuart, showed me, are things which I'll be eternally grateful for, both in themselves and anything else. I mean, I think at the stock level, it was always, it'd be certainly unfair on Chris, Jonathan, Nick, lots of the guys, Melissa, Chris, lots of people to name, too many people to name. Tremendously unfair on the analytic team that we've had alongside us to sort of reduce it to just Stuart and me arguing the whole time. And so Jonathan in particular, who's now doing this co-manager with me of the product, had a huge impact on the portfolio even before he was called co-manager of the product. That wasn't a big, I mean, I know it could be perceived like that from the outside. I think what Stuart did for me was A, what Stuart did for me was much more make me a better person and fund manager at a general level rather than specifically. And interestingly, at specific level, weirdly, it includes what we did last year where I talked to him a lot. It's where he's really brilliant is because he's slightly more skeptical than I might be. And I think he'd accept that as a, I think that's one of the things, you know, actually what was really noticeable was where his impacts were utterly decisive was actually where he became convinced of something you didn't expect him to be convinced of. And actually was decisive. When I look back, he was far more influential on the positive views that we took being aggressive than what one might from the outside perceive knowing us both of thinking that he was a limiting thing. And interestingly, last year is a good example. When I was chatting to him saying that this is what we should be doing, we shouldn't be shorting, etc. Almost the thing that convinced me most to do it was the fact that he says, of course, you've got to do that. His input on positive decisions has always been the thing I always think. And it's probably not a bad investment proposition that when people say something that isn't their normal thing, actually, it turns out to be a lot more accurate. And to be honest, I think the main thing, hopefully for Stuart as well, but for both of us has been that working together for, what was it, 20 odd years and creating a team of people, it was always great fun working with Stuart. And there was a kindness implicit in all of us, hopefully, that, you know, and you made the point at the very beginning, I think the luckiest thing about my career has been working with kind and nice people who are funny. And Stuart is by a long way the greatest example of that. And I think, although we probably didn't appreciate it all, in retrospect, the fact that coming into work was fun all the time, as it is now, with one of the nice things about the team today is the amount of laughing you hear, and actually their desire to come into the office now has been incredibly high. And Mercury was the same, that if you're creating an enjoyable working environment, is actually much more important than to the sustainability of any success we've had than the odd decision.
So you talked earlier on, and I want to come back to it, about the challenge as a fund manager of doing nothing. We interviewed Simon Hallett, who's the CIO of Harding Loevner, who are an $80 billion asset manager in the US that have a terrific track record. And I use the expression that we have a propensity in this business all to water our weeds and to trim our roses. Yeah. How have you managed and changed in that whole process of doing nothing sometimes, which is the best thing to do?
I think there are two distinct aspects to that. One is, I think when one starts with a position, one rarely frames it the way one should. Normally one frames analysis on a company of should I buy it or should I sell it? And actually, if like us, you have, I don't know, a 40 stock portfolio out of maybe 10,000 stocks you could hold. And even if you're running a short book as well, maybe another 30 or 40 shorts on top of that. The reality is that actually one should try to frame a debate around a company in terms of, am I a buyer of this or not doing anything in this one, rather than am I a buyer of it, a seller of it. And when one comes to cutting the positions the other side, normally the debate around should we hold something or not is around there's a weakness in this company that you haven't thought about and it's going to go wrong. Actually, what should happen, and thankfully I think it's certainly something I'm aiming for now, is that for the company to be your 41st favorite company in the world out of 10,000, it should be just that it's less good than the really exciting thing you just bought. And it's where you fund that. It shouldn't be anything to do with the fact that it's going to go wrong. And yet all the narrative around analyzing positions, it tends to end up with this sort of binary debate of buy versus sell, rather than critical evidence debate or sufficient evidence debate of buy versus do nothing. So I think the starting point is, how does one get oneself structured? I think it's one of the best reasons for running a concentrated position as well, actually, frankly, is to improve one's 40 isn't that concentrated. But I think running a finite number of stocks, almost whatever it is the best advantage of it, is it's the easiest way to get your sell discipline right. And so I think it's the first one that says that. To your other point, which is okay, and that's kind of how we try and avoid the other problem. So I always try and just say, look, given a blank sheet of paper, what are my 50 favorite shares? I mean, there's obviously some portfolio construction around that. But to the question of what's one's 50 favorite shares at the point in time, and if something doesn't get into that, it's not in the portfolio. And if it does get into that, great, you're not going to change very much. You know, that's 90% of it, I would say. And of course, behind that is a constant look for new ideas. For that to work well, you have to have X number of potential ideas coming up each quarter, such that the more exciting new stuff that gets into your portfolio, the better decision making on the rest of the portfolio comes through. And so certainly at the moment, one of the things where we've, I think, got a relatively settled portfolio in aggregate, it probably won't look wildly different, and certainly a bit like the tech portfolio of 10 years ago feels like one where thematically it's going to hopefully have some duration to it. One of the things we've tried very hard to do is make sure that we keep looking at new names, keep looking at new companies. And I think the benefit from that is that, to me, is the way we're going to get the best defense against stale analysis elsewhere. But again, this comes back perhaps to where I am in my career, and my natural thing is that I don't have a problem being patient with things. You know, I'm good at that. What I've got to do is worry about the other side of that, which is how does my patience not make me fail to panic when I should? Now, for other fund managers, especially young ones, I imagine it's kind of the other way around. It's probably very, very hard, I would imagine, to... And I think it comes back also to another really important point, which is you talked earlier about fund management brands, but equally every fund manager who's running money for other people, I think one of the things we've tried to do is structure products differently through time, run a lot of different products. To me, the logic of that is that relationship between you, the fund manager, and your client has to be aligned if you're going to take good fund management decisions. Our clients, I think, we write to them a lot. They understand it. We see them a lot. We're very transparent about it.
That's a good point to shift gears. You're seeing some of the opportunities here in the UK. And I wonder if you could just talk us through how you arrived at that perspective.
The economic problem was an exogenous one, not something structural within the economy, and therefore potentially was capable of being alleviated very quickly. Where I think it was quite like a war and economically is people having to do something much more quickly than they'd done before. Normally wars are accelerators of change because there's a set of discoveries that you make about how you do stuff more quickly or how you adapt. I'm trying to be a tiny bit careful of how far I push the analogy because you want an accurate picture of today. You don't want an accurate picture of yesterday. I think some things I would pick out, though, is the second point that's different is that effectively the government just gave people money this time. It didn't build a load of warships. What you've got is a weird situation where GDP was depressed. What happened in the other post-war situations was demand was here. You then had a recession pretty quickly afterwards because that demand disappeared, which ultimately was replaced by other stuff. This time around, actually, if anything, the economic recovery, I suspect, is going to be even stronger because its base is people having a lot of money, more money than they normally had. That normalization should happen quicker. And this productivity point, which I think is incredibly interesting, you know, certainly when we talk to people making vaccines, for instance, I can speak to companies which are seeing sort of thousandfold benefits in productivity in the healthcare space. And, you know, those thousandfold benefits in productivity will in turn create new opportunities to make for drugs, for instance. There's definitely companies that, through what they've learned in vaccine manufacture, are going to effectively enable the cost of making pharmaceuticals to go down a lot. That in turn, hopefully, will enable those pharmaceuticals to be available to a lot more people with huge human benefit. And then when one think about the online model, clearly the acceleration of trends that we've seen in COVID online, at some level, the reason that you can get your groceries delivered to you in an hour, whereas a year ago it would have taken you a week to get your groceries delivered online, is because the volume of groceries ordered online has gone through the roof, and the enthusiasm that's created has created a ton of capital to build out a whole new infrastructure system of people on bikes that didn't exist. Now, obviously, debate what the returns will be on that, but that acceleration of capital investment that comes from the learnings established through a period of rapid change seems to me at least as true in COVID as it was in some of the world wars.
I wasn't clear on why the productivity changes, particularly in the medical sphere, have actually come about, though.
So obviously, if you take the most important of all these, the idea that a vaccine got done in 12 months, when everyone, or lots of vaccines got done in 12 months, which at a human level has to be one of the most remarkable achievements of all time. But that ability to do something in a year that historically would have taken 5 years is only, I'm sure, happened because of that focus on resource and focus on motivation. And we know what a remarkable achievement it is. But once it's been done once, you can expect that to translate. Let's take vaccines as a very narrow thing. Once people know a vaccine can be manufactured in a year, you've got to assume that the set of things that now could be vaccinated against is going to massively expand. And the ways in which they've done that are lessons that hopefully can be generalized. As I said earlier, the one I know about because I've seen it is the manufacture of vaccines has yielded, or the sequencing of genomes, for instance, both the use of those and the ability to do that productively has now been proven in a way that no one could quite imagine. And in both cases, either the benefit or the cost being way better than we'd expected, I would hope and would assume that we'll have generalizable applications over the next 5 or 10 years.
Which is a good time to talk about Oxford. You've commented that it is so important to the economic and cultural health of the UK. I think you're certainly very excited about in the context of entrepreneurialism and research. Yeah. You're very involved with OSI, which is Oxford Sciences Innovation, which has, of course, been incubating some great companies or some potentially great companies. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there and your involvement.
I'm going to be a tiny bit constrained because obviously as a director of a company, albeit an unlisted one, I wouldn't want to confuse a personal view of something with what potentially might be viewed as an official view. So everything I say should be prefaced by being my personal view of it. So OSI was set up and two or three other people, well, a lot of other people, to provide a sort of centralized funding for the development of some of the companies that were coming out of Oxford. And we got a very good shareholder base globally and had some brilliant executive and non-executive help to sort of inspire it. A guy called Dave Norwood did an amazing job of finding a ton of fascinating companies that we've founded, I think, 70-odd companies in the first 5 or 6 years of it. And as one would have hoped, the thing that's been a given is that the IP within it is world-class. Normally, when you see an early-stage company, the opportunity is obvious, but whether they're any good at it is a question mark. With Oxford, it's completely the other way around. You're always getting something that's uniquely at the cutting edge of academia, and you know, often the challenge is to say, okay, what's the way of translating that into an economic outcome? I think the lovely thing has been that even within those 5 years and with tons of learnings that are still to come through, you can see that the opportunity that we'd identified was there, and you can see the relevance, the vaccines being an example, albeit one of many, where, you know, given proper capital and some help from an advice perspective, this intellectual advantage that Oxford and the UK has can be converted into real business outcomes. And I think there's probably two things that I've really noticed there. One is the linkage between once people imagine capital is there, the scope of their ambition for the companies goes up a lot. I mean, I think the UK has been beset by the problem that there's always been an assumption that there won't be any capital there, and therefore people have failed to build, have failed to think in terms of the scale of companies. They've often ended up not building a platform, but building an application, as it were. And I think that I can point to several examples in the OSI portfolio, but also there are lots of examples within the OSI portfolio, but plenty of examples outside that once people think a lot of capital is available, they build bigger businesses and more impactful businesses, and they take longer to do it. So I think that's been very well proven. I think it's kind of three things that we've learned, all of which I think are generalizable outside Oxford to the rest of the UK, actually. One is that the assets genuinely are world-class. The intellect, what we constantly find, normally with early-stage companies, the opportunity is obvious and the question of differentiation is not obvious. In Oxford, it's completely the other way around. The academic differentiation is uniquely good, and sometimes, not always, but sometimes it's the challenge and the expertise that you need is to say, okay, exactly what is the business model that goes alongside that to create the opportunity. But we've already seen in many, many fields that the companies being created there are addressing big problems in a way that hasn't been addressed before. So I think the scope, as one would hope, has done that. And then two subtler things I would say that are quite important. One is definitely the case that even if it's the prospect of significant capital being invested, just changes the scope of ambition of the companies in a really positive way, I think, in that certainly I would hope, and I think I do sincerely believe that not just OSI, because I think it's a general trend, hopefully, that's coming within the UK venture system, but I think there was definitely a case 10, 15 years ago that the absence of capital just meant people took small elements of the problem and tried to solve it. Whereas I think what we're trying to create now in Oxford and is companies that can be real meaningful global leaders in a platform or in a technology rather than just parts of a problem. And I think we won't succeed in any, I'm sure if our hit rate on that is 1 in 50, we'll have done tremendously well. But I think to the extent we get successes, I'd be very disappointed if they weren't really meaningful companies of the future in really important domains. And then secondly, I think the thing that's really struck me having been there is just the multiplier. You know, you hear about the multiplier effect on GDP. It's fascinating, you know, so for instance, I'll get the statistic wrong slightly, but I think I heard that our company's requirement for lab space is equivalent to the last, I don't know, 10, 20 years building of lab space in Oxford in the next year, and that's only going to go up. The multiplier effect you can see very vividly is that you form lots of companies, they invest wisely and hopefully grow as businesses. the overall infrastructure, the multiplier effect on economy as a whole is really incredibly easy to see. You know, the number of hotels being, they're not directly related purely by any stretch of the imagination to OSI, but a thriving economic ecosystem pops up in lots of different ways. And that's been really encouraging. And I think probably if I was the government, I'd be interested partly as to, I think the point that if you have these IP sources, they tend to have, or IP clusters, they tend to just have much bigger economic effect than probably the way in which they're typically measured, I think is definitely generalizable.
So I know the government does consult with you along with others about thinking. And I remember you said to me what the government's industrial strategy needs to be is to have a short mission statement, but a long plan. And you have said that you think UK political risk is mispriced and you're quite intrigued with some of the opportunities beyond Oxford. What do we need to see the government do?
Well, to start with, I think there's a couple of things which are important to differentiate. First, from a pure listed stock market perspective, as we're seeing with all these bids, I do think the global investor is viewing the UK through a rear view mirror of political risk rather than a prospective mirror of it. And so almost systemically, a UK exposed company will be trading at a big discount to its peers in any part of the world. And to be honest, I think one can like it. You know, I don't have particularly strong political views, but to me, when I look forward in the UK, it's a relatively stable situation compared to many others, and certainly not meriting the discount that the last 5 years would have merited. So I think there's a cyclical aspect to it. I think then to your question about the structural side of things, I think probably my observation there would be twofold. One is that Britain is incredibly well placed in a world that's going to get more IP oriented, and where the UK economy has a slew, Oxford being one of them, a slew of assets that have the capacity to drive huge economic growth if they're properly invested in or nurtured. And the thing I always see about the UK, we had this with football clubs beforehand, was that the number of brands, assets, whatever you want to call it, that are unique to the UK but have global relevance, I would say is unparalleled. What's really intriguing about them is often, as an investor, is that often those assets, either by the government or by investors, are viewed as financial liabilities. You know, if I took Manchester United, for instance, when we first invested in it 20 years ago, you know, I was sitting there going, or Stuart and I were sitting there going, this is the most resonant brand in the UK. You go to Africa, you'll see Coca-Cola and Man United badges next to one another. And yet the stock market was sitting there saying they don't immediately make any money and therefore they're not worth anything. And by the way, football clubs are, which they were probably right about, ironically, you know, sinkholes for capital or whatever the right phrase is. And I guess that question is, so I think that opportunity is huge in the UK. I think the same thing was true of, you know, think about universities. For a long, long time, they were funded as a drain on the exchequer, you know, whereas actually, to my mind, they're some of the best, doing the most important stuff that we see in the UK. Same, I'm sure we could apply to a couple of other industries. I think what's interesting to me now, and if you take Man United as the example, had Sky not turned up and injected a ton of capital to mean that Manchester United could buy Ronaldo, would their IP have persisted? Probably not. So the fact that a ton of investment went into their area now is great, because you get this virtuous circle of that reinforces the IP of the asset, and in a global world, the asset's worth a lot more, et cetera, et cetera. I think the same challenge applies to most of these other assets. If you take television, for instance, to talk about something I know nothing about. We probably have several of the best brands in the world, a huge creative industry. What's the way in which that competes with Netflix long term? Quite hard to see at the moment. And you would worry, I think, from the outside of saying, well, X that investment, is that relevance going to be there? So I think one's got both the opportunity and responsibility that we've got this world-class IP, and we probably don't have enough investment going into it at a point where globalization and changes that we talked about elsewhere are so profound that if you don't invest now, you may lose your IP structure. And so I think the challenge for the government to me would be, how do they, and this may not be a private sector thing, how do they ensure that these IP assets are nurtured, or these assets that we have in the UK are nurtured, both to maximize their immediate economic impact, but also to get the notion that if they're invested in properly, they're going to end up being assets in 10 years' time that are materially more valuable. You know, are we? And I think there's lots and lots of examples of that. I mean, we can go into individual ones, but this basic point, which is we're at a point where the world as a whole is investing in IP. We've got a load of great investment of IP assets that may or may not get invested in. Some of them, I suspect, like universities, regardless of OSI, it probably will happen anyway because it's sufficiently obvious. Man United, it's definitely obvious it's going to happen. But lots of other ones, lots of the heritage assets that we have.
Do you want to talk about one specific one that's on your mind?
One area we're thinking about a lot is conservation. I think for any number, and what's so wonderful about Britain is the range of different ways in which one becomes a world leader in it. But, you know, Britain is an authority on conservation. Conservation is undoubtedly going to be, to my mind, initially a massive consumer priority, but because of that, therefore a big industry over time, quite rightly. You know, it's something I do a lot of work in. And the question of whether Britain is the market, is Britain the epicenter of conservation expertise in 10, 15 years time? And if so, how, will hinge on all kinds of things. It will potentially hinge on the degree to which, if you look at did Britain become the financial service industry, you can see the sort of slight randomness with which those things happen. But definitely for me, I think the opportunity in the UK to harness the social and economic good that could create is one that's going to require investment from either the public or private sector. And it's not immediately obvious where that investment will come from as of now. Now, that may not matter because in the same ways with financial services, there actually wasn't very much investment in financial services and still turned out fine. But that would be a good example, I think, of something where you could imagine it going either way over the next 10 years. And also the lovely thing for me is thinking about one's children and potential future generations. The world, in the same way as my parents' generation probably didn't think about financial services, but it employed both of us and lots of other people. Wonderful thought to have that if we do get this right, you know, hundreds of thousands of people will achieve both purpose and employment through being part of the world leader in conservation services.
Now, we talked a little bit about sport in the context of your football investments, and you were an early investor there, but I know you obviously, not only do you love your sports, but you're an investor in Flutter. You, I think, spent time with Team GB in some capacity at the Olympics. What have you learned that you've either applied or what have you wanted to observe and derive from it?
I mean, the thing I've most learned, not just from sport, but to the extent that what one's trying to do in one's daily job is improve one's decision-making under uncertainty. Sport, same way defence did a long time ago, is probably one of the ways in which extreme decision-making happens. And, you know, if one's periodically lucky enough to get an understanding of how people with very different objectives and mindsets to myself actually deal with that decision-making, you know, in the same way as I always find out, whenever I meet someone who has to take decisions quickly, I always find myself intrigued by how they do it and whether there's anything I learn from that. So definitely the sporting world is one which I like from that. And also this commitment to exceptional performance. You know, if you said sport, much more than any film manager, sportsmen have to, the combination of preparation and optimizing point in time performance is an elite. Anyone trying to do a job really well should learn from other people who have to do the job really well to do it at all. And sports people do that. I think the same is true of lots of other industries as well. But yeah, I think the uncertainty, the example I usually use when I'm quoting this is talking about, I forget, you'll know which one it was, but remember Tiger Woods playing on a very hot golfing day, you know, biggest, hits the ball further than anyone else in the world. And he decided not to take his driver out in the open, i.e. take away his biggest strength, because he sat there worrying about it and decided to use his strength to take less risk by not going in the bunker because he might hit it too far. And, you know, I remember watching that, thinking that is just the best bit of, not fun management, but the best bit of risk management I've seen, not least because it's recognizing your strength and your weakness. When I think about that notion of your strength becoming your weakness and how do you aim off for it, actually Tiger was not taking his driver out at, I want to say Hoylake, but your listeners will, several of your listeners that I know will definitely be able to correct me on that if I'm wrong. But yeah, exactly. But that sort of thing, even Gareth Southgate at the moment, you know, the ability, I mean, take Gareth Southgate's selection, we probably don't want to go through too far on this, but, you know, the ability to adapt his selection to different things in the face of criticism, exactly the kind of decision-making that one would hope one could keep in one's mind. And I think it goes to a broader point, which is I find it quite hard to learn. With myself, I try to say, actually, I'm probably more like two things. One, learning from other people, I just find easier than learning from myself. And two, I think there is an element generally in fund management where narrative around, you talked about it yourself earlier, actually one's trying to replicate one's successes, and yet almost no one ever asks you the question of what was the key aspect to your success in this particular investment that you want to replicate. And definitely with young fund managers, I would definitely say to them, work out what it is you do well first, and then worry about what you do badly second, because what you're trying to replicate is what you do well rather than badly.
Do you ever think, gosh, what would I have done if I hadn't gone into managing money?
Yeah, all the time. I make it more explicit. I always try very hard at points like last year where I was deciding what I really wanted to do for the next 5 or 10 years to start from the premise of what will I do if I don't manage money rather than what would I have done? So I think, you know, in the same way as with one's portfolio, things one doesn't invest in the portfolio should be the things that are less good than things you're actually investing in. I would definitely, and it's much easier to calibrate them from imagining what they are and seeing, okay, this is better than this. When I think about doing fund management, I've very clearly thought about every year, or every 5 years or so, I would have a proper think about, okay, what else would I do at this point in time? And am I sure I want to do fund management more than that? I think that hopefully will be a question I always ask, regardless of whether I'm doing fund management or something else. And usually the challenge has been a subset of something. Hopefully I've got reasonably wide range of interests. I think thus far I've never found anything particularly credible that fulfills two conditions. One is it's not a subset of something I'm already doing in fund management and therefore something I've... And two, where doing it as an investment isn't better than doing it without applying. And I think within that investment point, there's probably two aspects. One is I don't think I'm very good at running stuff. The detail of running stuff, if you go back to Lansdowne, I was right to say that I don't want to be somewhere where it requires me to run a business to run fund management, because actually I'd be very bad at running a business. So I think the detail, one of the things I've got huge respect for, having seen it a bit with OSI, is the skill of actually running a business is one I don't have. And so, and actually don't particularly enjoy. And is a very, very specialized skill. And so, you know, actually me being an investor outsourcing the management of a company to someone else is definitely something I'm better at than that. And I'm hugely thankful to all the companies I've invested in for doing that for me. It's one of the biggest luxuries as an investor is that you don't actually have to do a lot of the hard work is done by other people. And secondly, I think, and this applies in lots of worlds, is that hopefully the perspective that an investor can bring of should I direct money here or here, or should I apply more capital to this or less capital, actually I'm normally okay at that. And that piece of advice, with all the analysis that comes behind that, gives me a huge, A, hopefully retrospectively some impact in that, and B, I think suits my skill set better than that. So not sure what else I'd be.
But it's quite clear to me and to anybody else who knows you that you are extremely busy. You have these investments that are public and private within the fund. You do a number of other things. How do you balance and how do you manage your time?
Again, I'd start from the premise that I think I probably fail on that. So I frame it a different way, which is how do I try and optimize it, and recognizing again this point about weaknesses. I know that is inevitably going to be the downside of stuff. I think probably a couple of things, hopefully, and if my family are listening, A, I'm incredibly grateful to them for putting up with me, especially my wife, Genevieve, who does put up with me being far more busy than I should be. I think hopefully I've done an okay job of never compromising the time I have with them. That's the starting rule of all this, is that ruining one's personal life in an effort to optimize one's professional life would be utter failure. And so I would hope neither my children nor my wife would ever feel that the time pressure that I have from work has compromised them. So the way I've tried to manage it, I've tried in lots of different ways. And again, to the point about sportsmen you made earlier, one of the things I'm fascinated by is how other people do it, because I don't think I do it particularly well. What I've tried to do more and more is say, I need to know, in the short term, I'm very, very lucky with Penny and Kate, my assistant, who kind of keep me in, stop, rightly ask the question of, are you sure you want to be doing this? When I say, yeah, I'll take every single meeting. And so the short term, I can kind of manage, again, a bit on this relative basis where I've got this list of things and I say, yes, 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 no. If I see the options, I can usually choose the right option. The long term is the harder thing. What I've tried to do and actually been doing for the last 3 or 4 years is say, I need to know on a 3 to 5 year view what I'm not going to be doing. I need to basically have a view that each year I need to save 10% of my time by not doing something I'm doing today. And to do that, especially given one's commitments to other people and so forth, that needs planning. So I need to have a long-term plan of where I look at what I'm doing today and say, how do I cut out 10% of my time? So shorting's a good example of that. But the basic premise has to be you have a very clear value set of things which are the non-negotiables, as it were, and hopefully one can do that and be planning for it. I think the hardest thing for me is actually I would differentiate time from emotional energy. I mean, I think as I get, maybe this is a sign of age, but time is relatively easy to manage. You've got structure. I think the thing I've recognized better in the last couple of years is that emotional energy is actually the key unit, because actually you can always extend your working day if you're really enjoying it. And I think both in terms of recognizing the value of emotional energy as both something to aspire to and a cost, that's probably made me a bit more efficient working-wise. So what do I mean by that? Practical examples of that. I really like the fact that, hopefully it's always been the case, but I really value the fact that the team that I work with today is laughing a lot. And if you asked me to justify that, it would be partly the kindness points we made earlier. But actually, I would also argue a productivity aspect of that, that we've been really lucky that as soon as, I probably shouldn't say this, but as soon as people have had the opportunity to come back to work, they've really wanted to on our team. That's undoubtedly created ideas that otherwise wouldn't have happened and why it was important they did. I doubt they would have done that as quickly had they not really enjoyed being, that enjoyment aspect has meant that probably was less of a hardship for them than it might be for lots of other jobs. And conversely, I think also maybe it's just a post-COVID sort of realization that, you know, just life's a bit too short for some of the things one wastes emotional energy on. I'm hopefully a relatively calm person, but I think ascribing one underprices the real cost of things that don't make you feel calm.
And so is there something, if you could advise a 20-year-old Pete Davis, is there one piece of advice you would give?
A 13-year-old Pete Davis, I would always try and encourage people to be curious and interested in things. And if you're curious and interested about something, then probably you're going to do it quite well and generally be quite happy about things. I think probably the advice I would give both age groups is to be confident enough to be enthusiastic. What I see a lot is that there's this element that I think is kind of still in, especially for equity investors, that you were asking earlier about Amazon, for instance, which is a good example of this, is that it's so easy to be cynical. And certainly I always notice in groups of, I don't know, 10, 20, they're often led by a cynic, a group of 10 to 20. But actually really important things tend to get done by people who are optimistic. And I think proper enthusiasm needs to be conditioned by feeling like one's done enough work to differentiate it, one can understand it. But ultimately, the willingness to allow oneself to be enthusiastic at it when it would have been much easier to be cynical was probably the most important thing I should have learned from that. And certainly to the 20-year-old me and the 13-year-old me, I know how difficult it can be to be enthusiastic about things. You know, to actually, you do see this in fund management. I mean, there's definitely an element whereby I can think of several fund managers who are like this, where it's just so nice to be bearish. And this was one of the reasons I wanted to give up shorting as well, was it's kind of almost too intellectually comforting sometimes to sort of be pointing out the negatives of things. You know, for instance, talking about the UK at the moment, the fact I see a ton of opportunity probably is not, you know, you can see people beginning to look at it now. In many ways, probably if I've got a differentiation, it's my willingness to actually say that rather than actually my analysis of spotting it. You know, lots of people I think would probably agree that the shares are too cheap, but I think hopefully the thing we're getting right is being willing to not worry about looking stupid. And certainly for my kids, I think that willingness to be enthusiastic, I think also implies a degree of confidence. Having the confidence to do that is probably the right way to express it.
So that's a lovely time for me to ask you the final question, which is, hypothetically, beautiful sunny day in Oxford, you're taking a punt from the Charwell Boathouse. You can have two people with you on that boat that you have never met from the wide world. Who would they be?
I think both of them, given my punting skills, would... The key criteria would be, I think, Duncan Goodhue and Adam Peaty would probably be the key. Is Adam Peaty? Yeah, it is Adam Peaty, yeah. I think two good swimmers would be the starting point, probably.
So, Peter, you've been very generous with your time. So, a huge thank you. I have learned a lot. It's also highlighted lots of my own shortcomings in an investment career that I have had. I'm going to take away three things particularly. One is the comment you just made that it's been intriguing how people coming back in the office has really helped idea generation. And I think that might be overlooked by lots of people thinking about a new or modified business model. But two other observations. One is to people at all stages, but perhaps very specifically in the investing world, figure out what you do well. And I think to young people and to people who are less young, be curious and be enthusiastic. Incredibly important attributes, which I also try and encourage in my children. So with that, I'm going to thank you again. Pete, it's been a terrific pleasure.
No, I've thoroughly enjoyed it, as I do all of them. I'm very flattered to be asked to do this, and certainly I've loved listening to the other ones, and thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure for me.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.